Good afternoon, and thank you very much, Paul, for that introduction. It's a pleasure to be back in Melbourne. Probably not the same pleasure I get, though, from attending the Australian Open, but nevertheless, it's very good to be here. I'd also like to thank the CFA Institute and CFA Societies Australia for the invitation to speak this afternoon. I also want to acknowledge the work that the CFA and its members have done in promoting the integrity of capital markets and the provision of ethical investment advice. Over recent years, unfortunately, we've seen too many ethical lapses in the global financial services industry and the bonds of trust between investors and institutions have been strained. Strengthening these bonds is critical to the financial services sector again playing its important role in promoting a strong and vibrant global economy. So I wish you and all your members the best in pursuing this important task. Our confidence is, of course, also important, a factor influencing business decisions to invest and to expand. Indeed, it's a lack of confidence that's been one of the factors holding back investment in many advanced economies over recent years. And so given this is the CFA's Australia Investment Conference, I thought it appropriate to focus my remarks this afternoon on this topic of investment. I want to spend some time discussing recent investment trends in Australia, particularly the investment outcomes in the non-mining part of the economy. And then I'd like to look forward and to discuss what the outlook might hold. Now, I think it's useful to start off with a global context. As you're no doubt aware, over recent years, the Australian economy has performed much better than the economies of most other developed countries. We avoided a recession during the financial crisis, although growth recently has been a bit below average. Our banks have remained sound. Public debt levels are comparatively low. The Reserve Bank has not had to expand its balance sheet massively. And as we saw again yesterday, inflation has been close to target. Very few other countries could make such claims. But my focus today is on the story on investment. Since 2008, the developed economies have been in an investment drought. And hopefully you can see this in this graph. Over the last 4 years, the level of investment relative to GDP in the G7 has been the lowest for at least 50 years. And investment in the world as a whole has also been very low. Now, in Australia, the picture is very different. Rather than experiencing an investment drought, we've had an investment boom, particularly in the private sector. You can see this here. Recently, business investment has peaked at over 18% of GDP, its highest level in more than 50 years. And the nation's overall capital stock, if you include both private and public capital, has been expanding at around 5% a year recently, and that's the fastest rate of increase since the early 1970s. In contrast to this, in most other developed economies, the level of investment has barely been enough to replace the depreciation of the existing capital stock. Now, the reasons for this difference are well understood. Most of the advanced economies have been dealing with the fallout of the severe banking and financial problems of the late 2000s. In contrast, we avoided these problems and we've been benefiting from the growth in Asia. This growth has pushed up the prices of many of our commodities, which has encouraged investment in the extraction of Australia's natural resources, particularly iron ore, coal, and natural gas. This investment has boosted our resource exports and will provide an important source of national income for many years to come. This aggregate picture, though, hides some large differences across sectors of the economy. As you can see here, mining investment has been extraordinarily strong. Last year, it was equivalent to around 8% of GDP, which is much higher than any previous mining boom, at least for over a century. In the non-mining sector, however, investment's been quite weak. Indeed, as a share of nominal GDP, non-mining private business investment's currently around 3 percentage points lower than its average over the period from 2005 to 2008. And as you can see in this chart, it's not much above levels seen in the early 1990s recession. If we take into account public investment, which has also been quite low, then total non-mining investment as a share of GDP is below the trough that was recorded in the early 1990s, and you can see that in the top line of this chart. In this sense, the profile for non-mining investment in Australia is not dissimilar to the profile for overall investment that we've seen in many of the other developed economies. This weakness in investment outside the resources sector in Australia is widespread across industries. According to the most recently available ABS data, in 16 out of the 18 individual non-mining industries, the level of investment is at or below the average level over the years from 2005 to 2008. The two exceptions here are the utilities sector, where there's been significant private investment in electricity distribution and water supply, and in the agricultural sector, which has benefited from high global food prices. Now, this low level of non-mining investment has occurred despite corporate balance sheets being in generally sound shape, and despite firms having significant holdings of liquid assets. It's also occurred despite financial institutions reporting that they are willing and able to lend. And it's also occurred despite lending rates being at record lows for both large and small businesses, as you can see in this chart. So the obvious question here is, why is this happening? As usual, there's no single answer, but I want to highlight four factors. The first is a technical one, but it's a relevant one nevertheless. These investment figures that I've quoted are for nominal investment relative to nominal GDP. And most of the time, this provides us with a reasonable guide as to what's going on. But over recent years, the price of capital equipment's fallen markedly, partly due to the appreciation of the exchange rate, and that's reduced the price of imported goods. The lower prices for imported goods means that a given amount of capital spending, the economy obtains more units of capital. And as a result, while total non-mining investment as a share of GDP is lower than it was in the recession of the early 1990s, the non-mining capital stock is increasing a little more quickly than it was at that time. So in a sense, we're getting more bang for our buck. The second and ultimately more important factor, though, is the exchange rate. As I've talked about on previous occasions, Australia's floating exchange rate has played an important role in stabilising our economy. The appreciation of the Australian dollar since the mid-2000s is perhaps the single most important reason why the Australian economy has digested a boom in mining investment without overheating and without developing the type of imbalances that typically accompany such booms. Now, that's the good news. But in playing this stabilising role, there's also a downside. The exchange rate appreciation has taken the pressure off domestic capacity by making it cheaper for Australians to buy imported goods and by reducing the competitiveness of Australian production in export markets. In doing so, it's reduced the return on capital in those traded sectors that are not benefiting from the high commodity prices, and it's thus reduced the incentive to invest in these sectors. This is perhaps most obvious in the manufacturing and tourism sectors, where the level of investment as a share of GDP is very low by historical standards, and you can see this in this chart here. Indeed, in both of these industries, the current rate of investment is at or below the appreciation of the existing capital stock. And the low level of investment in the manufacturing sector is particularly noteworthy, as manufacturing has historically accounted for around 1/5 of total non-mining investment. The third factor that I want to discuss is the general lack of confidence by business. This lack of confidence can be seen in the various business surveys, and this graph here shows the NAB business survey. It's also clearly apparent through the Reserve Bank's regular program of meetings with firms across the country. The reported lack of confidence is consistent with firms being uncertain about the future and risk-averse in their decision-making. And so the logical question here is, why has business confidence and the willingness to take risk been so subdued? Again, there's no single answer, but many of the businesses that we've talked to over the past couple of years have cited uncertainty associated with the structural changes in the economy, including as a result of the high exchange rate. They've also cited the political environment, particularly the previously hung parliament. And they've also cited an increased regulatory burden. While we can't be sure, it is likely that each of these factors has affected the willingness of some firms to expand. A common message that we've received from business is that they thought it was worth waiting a while to see how things worked out before they made decisions that were costly to reverse. In the parlance of the economists, the option value of waiting has been seen to be quite high. But beyond these Australian-specific factors, I suspect there's also a deeper global factor at work here, and that's the legacy of the financial crisis. Recall that prior to the crisis, there was the great moderation. During that earlier period, the additional compensation that business required for taking a risk was quite small. Confidence was very high and volatility was low. But the financial crisis changed all this. It reminded us that bad outcomes were possible. We went from the great moderation to fears of another great depression. And since the crisis, the frequent news about the problems in the euro area and the possibility of political stalemate preventing the US government from meeting its financial obligations has only served to reinforce this idea. This scarring from the financial crisis on business psychology is still with us, and I suspect it will be with us for some time yet. And this scarring helps explain not only why investment is weak outside the resources sector in Australia, but also why investment is very low in many advanced economies, despite generally healthy corporate balance sheets, despite very low interest rates, and despite large-scale quantitative easing by the central banks. While recently we've seen some return to risk-taking in financial markets, potential owners of real capital in the developed economies have not yet been prepared to step forward in any significant numbers and to take a risk. Consumer demand has been soft and businesses have wanted to wait and to see what happens. They felt more comfortable leaving their money in bank accounts earning very low interest rates rather than taking the chance and investing in new capital. It's this change in corporate attitudes that I think is one of the enduring but underappreciated consequences of the financial crisis. At the aggregate level, the Australian economy has been shielded from its effects by developments in the resources sector, but clearly there are some sectors of the economy that are feeling the impact of this change. Finally, the fourth factor that I want to talk about that's had an effect on the overall level of investment in Australia is the change in household spending patterns. Unlike in earlier years, growth in household consumption is no longer running ahead of growth in household income. The step down in the rate of growth of retail spending in particular has reduced pressure on capacity in that industry, and it's affected rents for retail properties. And there's also been a reassessment of the appropriate model of retailing. Again, the result can be seen in the ABS's estimates of total investment in the retail sector, which again, as a share of GDP, is the lowest for many years. And the ABS data also suggests that this has had some flow-on effects to investment in wholesaling, which, as you can see, is also at quite low levels. So in summary, the high exchange rate, uncertainty, risk aversion, and changes in household spending behaviour have all weighed on non-mining investment over recent times. As a result, non-mining investment has made little contribution to growth in the overall economy. This is apparent in this chart, which shows how the contribution of different sources of growth to the overall economy has changed over the past year. As best we can tell, mining investment has actually declined, and you can see that in the second set of bars there, after it increased very strongly in the year to mid-2012. And reflecting the transition of the mining boom from one based on investment to one based on exports, net exports last year rose very strongly after they'd acted as a drag on growth in the previous year. So this transition from investment to exports is occurring, and it will continue to occur. So having looked back at what's happened so far, I now want to look forward. Over the period ahead, the level of mining investment is likely to decline substantially as existing projects are completed. The exact profile remains difficult to determine, but it would not be surprising if mining investment relative to GDP declined by 3 percentage points or more over coming years. It's important to point out that a decline of this magnitude should be manageable, just as the earlier rise was manageable. It will, however, require a further rebalancing of our economy. As part of this rebalancing, exports are set to grow very strongly, particularly when the large LNG projects come online. There'll also be slower growth in imports of capital goods as projects are completed. But these adjustments on the trade side will not be enough by themselves to ensure that growth in output and particularly employment is satisfactory. And this means that other forms of spending in the economy will need to pick up. Now, one of these other forms of spending is residential construction, and a modest rise there is underway, and that's a welcome development. Some lift in household consumption growth is also expected, although a return to consumption growth faster than income growth for an extended period is unlikely. It would also be unwelcome, given the relatively high levels of existing household debt. So this means that a pickup in non-mining investment is an important part of the story of the return of the Australian economy to trend growth. Indeed, our expectation is that this will take place, with growth in non-mining investment predicted to pick up to at least high single-digit rates within the next couple of years. This is, of course, a forecast, and there are the usual wide range of uncertainties around it. These include uncertainties, the appropriate steady-state capital output ratio for the economy, and the associated investment ratio. These important structural variables are influenced by a whole range of considerations, including the rate of total factor productivity growth, the rate of population growth, the rate of depreciation, and our industry structure. But from a more cyclical perspective, there are a number of factors that do support the outlook for a steady pickup in non-mining investment. And the three factors that I want to list, and they're clearly interrelated, are some depreciation of the exchange rate, an improvement in business confidence, and the very low level of interest rates. While the Australian dollar has appreciated over the past couple of months, on a trade-weighted basis, it is still around 8% lower than the peak in April this year. It's too early to see the impact of this on investment, although the depreciation of the currency has improved prospects in some areas of the economy. In particular, there are parts of the tourism and manufacturing industries where the outlook is now a little bit more positive, especially for firms that had earlier responded to the high exchange rate by doing whatever they could to make themselves more competitive. And the more positive outlook in the tourism industry is also being supported by the steadily increasing numbers of visitors from China. This depreciation of the Australian dollar since April is a welcome development, and a further depreciation would be helpful in rebalancing growth in the economy. Ultimately, floating exchange rates adjust to relative returns on capital across countries. When investment in Australia was high and rising, and investment elsewhere in the world was weak and falling, it was not surprising that the Australian dollar was at quite a high level. This was really a textbook response of a floating currency to an investment boom. But the textbook would also predict that as the mining investment boom in Australia unwinds, and hopefully investment in the developed economies picks up, that some realignment of the relative value of the Australian dollar would occur. Now, this process of realignment had started earlier in the year, although it's been interrupted recently, partly due to the changed outlook for US monetary policy. Whether we see a further adjustment remains unclear, but from today's perspective, a lower value of the Australian dollar would assist in lifting investment and activity in the sectors that have been constrained during the years of the mining investment boom. Now, the second factor on my list is an improvement in business confidence, which we've seen over recent months, and that's evident in this graph that I showed you earlier. This improvement in confidence is also apparent in our discussions with business across the country, and there's also been a lift in consumer confidence, and these, again, are positive developments. Just as a lack of confidence in the economy can be self-fulfilling, so too can a recovery in confidence. If businesses are prepared to spend, jobs tend to get created, incomes tend to rise, and people see opportunity where previously they saw none. So the important issue here is, will this improvement in confidence be sustained? Now, a fair amount depends upon what happens abroad. If global growth does turn out to be in line with most forecasters' central outlook, it's quite possible that confidence both overseas in Australia will be sustained at a higher level than it has been in recent times. But clearly there are a range of things that could go wrong, and the latest wrangling over the US debt ceiling provides just the latest example of developments that can undermine confidence. Beyond these international events, the domestic policy choices that we make also matter. Business confidence, and thus the preparedness to take risk, is likely to be higher if the policy environment is predictable and there's a strong commitment to ongoing reform to make markets work well and to boost productivity. Ensuring that regulation is fit for purpose is also important, and so too is ensuring that the general business environment promotes innovation. Now, all of these things are difficult to get right, but doing so is key to creating an environment where business is confident enough to take a risk, to buy some new capital, to hire some new workers, or to expand their operations. The third and final factor on my list is the low level of interest rates. The impact of these low rates is evident across a range of indicators, and it's further to run. In the housing market, prices and turnover have risen. As I noted earlier, dwelling investment is increasing. There are also signs of an increased appetite for borrowing by households, most notably among those purchasing a property to rent out. And more generally, households seem prepared to move out a little along the risk spectrum in an effort to increase their expected returns. Now, these developments are creating new business opportunities. So too is the steady growth in Australia's population, which remains considerably faster than in almost all other developed economies. At the current pace of growth, in 5 years' time, the population of Australia will be almost 10% higher than it is at present. When businesses are deciding today whether to take advantage of these opportunities, they face a low cost of borrowing and finance is available for sound projects. In time, this should help underpin a rise in investment across a whole range of industries in the economy. Now, of course, none of this is locked in. But together, a lower value of the Australian dollar, an improvement in business confidence, and low interest rates provide the basis for our outlook of a gradual lift in non-mining economy over the next couple of years. So thank you very much for listening, and Paul, I look forward to the questions. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Lowe. Quite a lot of questions, some terrible handwriting, so I'll do my best. One from me to start with. I live in Hong Kong, and I wanted just to ask you the big China question. Obviously, that's a key driver of mining investment, I guess, in the main. But when you look at your overall policy mix, how important is it to be a China watcher as far as the RBA is concerned? And what are your views on growth in China?
Yeah. Well, China is obviously incredibly important to us. Almost a third of our exports are now going to China. So what happens there is very important to commodity prices and therefore the outlook for investment in the economy and ultimately the exchange rate as well. So we spend a lot of resources internally looking at China. We have a team of six economists who study the Chinese economy, including someone who's permanently located in Beijing. By way of contrast, we have one person who looks at the US economy. So what's going on there is incredibly important to us. I think, again, what we're finding out is the pessimists about China are being proved wrong again. The recent growth numbers were encouraging, and I don't see any reason to fear that growth will be substantially weaker in the period immediately ahead. I think the challenge for China really is to reform its factor markets. The market for land, the market for labour, the market for capital, the market for energy, the market for corporate control. They're all incredibly regulated markets. And that's worked well for them up to now. But at some point, as they transition into a higher level of per capita income, those markets will need to be deregulated. It's not an issue that confronts them immediately. It's not a threat to growth this year or next, but over the medium term, it is an issue that I think they will need to manage very carefully.
Thank you. A bunch of questions really about the future direction of interest rates, as you as you might expect. I did ask Dr. Lowe whether there were any subjects I should steer clear of, and he said no. So I've got a pass to ask these. And kind of on both sides of the fence, really, would the RBA cut rates again to push the Australian dollar lower is one question linked to your FX comments earlier on. But then going back to that inflation number that was issued yesterday, does that uptick in inflation? And I know there were some statistics in there that may mean that's not necessarily the correct interpretation of that number, but does that higher inflation necessitate actually an end to the interest rate cutting cycle and the beginning of nudging interest rates up? So a couple of divergent views.
Thank you. Well, I said there were no questions that were off limit. There are only answers that are off limit.
Well said.
No, but they're both very good questions. On the issue of whether we would cut interest rates to get the Australian dollar lower, we've said a number of times that interest rates and the exchange rate are obviously linked. But not in the way that your question or the question suggests. One of the reasons we have low interest rates is because the exchange rate's very high. But the lower interest rates have not been with the intention of getting a lower currency. They've been with the intention of setting the effects on the economy of the high currency. And that's been the high currencies I outlined has been an important factor influencing investment in a number of sectors, and that is the low levels of investment there have meant activity in the economy has been a bit softer than it otherwise would have been, and interest rates in response to that have been lower. So there is a connection, but not of the one you suggest, because I think at the moment what's much more important for the value of the Australian dollar is US monetary policy, not Australian monetary policy. The value of the dollar has moved very much in line with changing expectations about whether the Fed was going to taper its asset purchases. On inflation, the numbers yesterday were a touch higher than we'd been expecting, but only a touch, and I wouldn't read very much into that. The inflation outlook in Australia still looks pretty benign. Wage growth has slowed considerably. Many workers are uncertain about future employment prospects, and the labour market has softened, and that's led to lower wage growth. That's occurring at the same time that there's a gradual lift in productivity growth in the economy. So growth in what the economists call unit labour costs has slowed down, and that gives us some confidence that the inflation outlook is relatively benign, even if we saw a further depreciation of the currency. It's unlikely that would move us away from our medium-term inflation target.
Thank you. A couple of questions on the mining boom. I know that wasn't really one of the subjects you particularly wanted to cover, but really the riches generated by the mining boom. The questions relate to whether Australia has missed the boat a little bit in building up a sovereign wealth fund, perhaps, with the riches that that mining boom has brought to the country.
Yeah, well, it's a good question, and it has a long history of political debate in this country.
Yeah.
It's true, the mining boom has been incredibly enriching for us. It's hard sometimes when you're living in our great capital cities a long way from the Pilbara just to understand what an impact it's had for us, or on us. I've described before this kind of chain of events that links what's happening in the Pilbara to the cafes in Melbourne. And people don't often see that chain, but it's real and it's there. And it starts with the high commodity prices pushing up investment and pushing up the exchange rate. And that means that the price of all our imported goods, if you look through the CPI, the price of all imported goods are basically either no higher or lower than they were 10 years ago. That's because of the mining boom. And the fact that the prices of almost everything we buy in the department store is lower than it was 10 years ago has generated income that we can spend on other things. And we spent a lot of those on services, including the cafes here in Melbourne. So there is a really clear link. It's hard for people to see, but it's there. And it's the mining boom is the reason Australia has enjoyed over the last decade, by the standards of developed economies, unprecedented income growth in per capita income. So we've done pretty well from it. Could we have done better? I don't know. I'll leave others to answer. But I think we shouldn't forget that we've done very well out of that. Australia is really, amongst the developed countries, the growth in our per capita incomes over the last 20 years, it hasn't been matched anywhere.
And yet that money that's been generated obviously hasn't been used in inward investment into some sectors of the manufacturing sector. So I guess that's really underpinning that question. Has Australia consumed too much and invested too little of those profits?
No, I think it's hard to support the proposition that we've consumed too much through the investment boom. And in fact, one could have worried, based on previous experience, that you have an investment boom, people feel fantastic about the future, and everyone goes on a spending and borrowing binge. The economy overheats, you have to have high interest rates, and ultimately you have a downturn. To our credit, that hasn't happened here. We didn't have a wage blowout during the investment boom. We didn't have a consumption blowout. We didn't have a borrowing blowout. The economy has digested what on any scale is an unprecedented boom in investment without developing major imbalances. The exchange rate appreciation, which has caused so many difficulties for so many people, I think was really key to that, and the change in household borrowing. So, no, I don't think we've spent too much out of this. We've done a pretty good job. We've digested this boom without causing imbalances in the economy. And I think if you'd said to most economists a decade ago this was going to happen to a mining investment, they would have said Australia was going to have an inflation problem, a wages problem, a borrowing problem. We've had none of that.
Right. And sort of a couple of questions on the sectors that you feel are potentials for Australia to be world-leading, perhaps in terms of exports as well as obviously just domestic issues. One question here speaks to non-mining energy, green energy, renewables and clean tech. Is Australia investing enough in that? And a sort of a linked question with that, what are your views on the best policy approaches to address the lack of competitiveness of Australian industry on a global basis? Is it solely an exchange rate issue, or are there deeper forces at work there?
Yeah. Well, a lower exchange rate would help the competitiveness of many of these industries. But a lower exchange rate shouldn't be the solution, the long-term solution here, because a lower exchange rate ultimately means less purchasing power for everyone in this room. So what we want is a strong, vibrant economy, not based on an artificially low level of the exchange rate, but a competitiveness based on strong productivity growth. And we see some signs of that of productivity growth picking up recently. I think the difficult times that many businesses have felt over the last 3 or 4 years has led many to look at their business practices, the way they manage their businesses, the technology they're using. So I do see Australian business responding here. It's quite likely that even if the currency was to come down further, as we expect it will in time, that we will have a high currency by historical standards. And that's because the global commodity prices relative to the price of manufactured goods is high because of what's going on in Asia, and that's not a 1 or 5 year development, that's a multi-year, perhaps a multi-decade development. So we will have a higher currency, I suspect, than we've had on average historically. And that means that Australian business needs to compete on the basis of technology, of human capital, of skills, of ideas. And so investment in education, in innovation, in infrastructure, they're all incredibly important ingredients into that story. As opposed to kind of what specific policies encourage that, there are others who are better placed to do it. But the general point is a relatively higher currency than we've had historically means we need to compete on the basis of our minds and our ideas, not on the basis of producing standardised goods for the world market.
Thank you. And the questions on policy mix, really. What is the single most important indicator you look at in setting monetary policy? And this is linked really to a couple of questions that people are asking on house prices in general and whether the RBA has been a little reckless in keeping interest rates for too low and promoting a house price bubble as well. So yeah. That's one angle of attack there as well.
Yeah. Well, there's no single indicator that dominates all others. If you pressed me, I would obviously have to say the inflation rate as a medium right. term, because all our decision making is based around the framework of a medium term inflation target. So that's how the analytical framework we use. So the updates we get on the CPI are obviously very important there. But your question touches on another issue that's been very topical here, and that's what's going on the housing market. One of the ways that easier monetary policy works is by obviously lowering the cost of borrowing, and people in response borrow more. Lower interest rates also typically mean higher asset prices. That's what the transmission mechanism requires. And what we've seen over the past year is lower interest rates, a slight but only very slight pickup in household borrowing, and higher house prices. It's what the transmission mechanism should deliver. If that were not happening, there'd be a real problem, because it would say monetary policy is not working. But the fact that that is happening says it is working. It is creating ripple effects through the economy. It is creating new opportunities. The concern would come if the growth in borrowing or the growth in house prices picked up to unsustainable rates. And at the moment, I think it would be hard-pressed to conclude that. But it's certainly possible that could happen. But to substantiate the idea that that's actually happening now, I think would be to discounting the standard monetary transmission mechanism, which is important.
Okay. And a couple of linked questions. One of them reads slightly controversially, and I'll try and find it in here. Something about Wayne Swan dipping into the reserve fund. Can you confirm that former Treasurer Wayne Swan had used the RBA fund to dip into to fund the abandoned surplus pursuit? So I have absolutely no idea what that means, but hopefully you do. And it sounded quite challenging as a question, so I thought I would ask it. And was there a lot of tension between Glenn Stevens and Wayne Swan over this?
I suspect this is alluding to the fact that yesterday the government announced that it was going to effectively add $8 plus billion of capital to the Reserve Bank. The history here is that a few years ago, when the exchange rate appreciated so much, the Reserve Bank suffered very large valuation losses on our foreign reserves. I think over a couple of years, we had valuation losses in excess of $5 billion. That's obviously significantly made a significant dent in our capital. And we'd been saying publicly for some time that it was the board's intention, desire, to rebuild that capital over time. And it is the case that last year a distribution was made to the government, and that was publicly aired at the time and subject to quite a lot of attention. I think the current government has decided to move quickly to the desired level of capital to make sure that the bank's balance sheet is of an unquestionable quality. And I think I see that really is our collective interest, because you want the central bank to have unquestioned ability to deal with a whole range of situations. And the board had wanted to get to that position over time, and what we're doing now is moving directly to that position.
I guess a related question to that, given that you're in charge of the risk management committee at the RBA, is what keeps you awake at night, effectively, and what are you doing about that? And does that $8.8 billion effectively give you the comfort level that you need to cope with US budget crises or any other exogenous events that might occur?
Yeah, well, the lack of capital had not been keeping me up at night, but I think we're in a much stronger position to deal with events that of an unpredictable nature that occur in the future. I think it was a prudent, sensible decision. What keeps me up at night? Well, the things that I kind of worry most about, I think it's back to one of your early questions about China, because if something went wrong there, that would really fundamentally reshape our outlook. But as I said, the likelihood of something going wrong there in the short term doesn't seem particularly high to me. The thing that worries kind of me most is that we get stuck in this world where business feels like it's not willing to invest. It just sees risk everywhere, whereas during the Great Moderation, people couldn't see risk anywhere. They're prepared to buy any financial investment. Investment in real capital was very high. And it's possible that one of the really enduring legacies of the crisis is just businesses just decide that they don't want to take risk, or they require such a high premium for taking risk. If that is the case, then the world gets stuck in a low growth equilibrium, and ultimately that's bad for everybody. I don't think that's inevitable, and it's not something you kind of worry about a piece of news coming today and causing us great anxiety, but it's one of those deep structural things that are there that mean that if it's true, then the world is stuck in a lower growth environment, or the developed countries in particular, than they previously were. And that would not be good for any of us.
There's a sort of linked question, really, which is the issues that Europe faces and the US faces. How much does the impact of those things tie your hands in terms of policy responses to more domestic issues here in Australia? I mean, what sort of constraints does that impose upon you?
I don't see these developments as tying our hands, but they're certainly a factor in the decision-making. The fact that Europe has struggled with its debt problems for so long is one of the factors that keep on chipping away, undermining confidence. The recent wrangling over the debt problems in the US, I think it's damaging in the sense that it, again, undermines confidence. Because what I think, if you look at the American corporate balance sheets, the level of interest rates, the amount of liquidity in the system, the fact that investment's been very low for a long period of time, all those things say it's about time for firms to step forward and buy capital equipment. And one of the things, at least, that's holding them back is this risk aversion. And I suspect one of the consequences of the events of the past 2 weeks is that reinforces the risk aversion on behalf of business. It's another reason to wait. another reason to just see what might happen, another reason to delay buying that piece of capital or committing to that new business or hiring that new worker. And it's that continual, the political environment in both the US and Europe continuing to give people reasons to delay is a big problem, because the fundamentals, that on, at least on the financing side, are there for recovery. We need people to feel that. Unfortunately, the problems at the political level in the US and the bank problems in Europe keep giving people reasons to delay. And that affects us, because it affects the global economy. It affects the outlook for US interest rates, and therefore it's affecting the Australian dollar as well. So these are all important factors in our deliberations, but I wouldn't describe them as kind of constraints in the way that they were limiting our options.
And a very, very broad question here. What is the biggest structural headwind facing the Australian economy today? Structural headwind. Well, that's a tough question. But
yeah, I'm not... Well, I don't know whether you think of the high exchange rate as a structural headwind. It's certainly something that, as I tried to outline in my remarks, that's affecting a lot of industries. And as I said, that the fact that it was high was useful in stopping the economy overheating, but it needs at some point to, as the investment boom comes off, we probably need a lower currency. The general business environment, I think, is another. Mm-hmm. It's a similar theme to the US, where the willingness of business to step forward, to take a risk, hire a worker, or buy a new business, creating that environment, I really see it's much more important than small changes in interest rates to getting the economy going again. And how you do that, it's, as I said, is very difficult to do, but I really see this as kind of crucial to the next stage of development in the Australian economy, getting that business environment right so people are prepared to take these risks.
I mean, you mentioned in your remarks that banks here in Australia were liquid and ready to lend. I mean, is that true in the small to medium-sized corporate sector? I mean, certainly in the rest of the world, there does seem to be a choke point there that banks do have money, and Dr. Poole was demonstrating that earlier on today, but there does seem to be this willingness only to lend to the big boys.
Yeah, I don't sense that's an issue here. There are obviously a number of banks have changed their business models, and credit is not available as freely on the same terms that it was before the financial crisis. I think that's clear, but whether that's the right benchmark or not, I think one could debate. And perhaps it was the previous set of conditions were the aberration, and we've moved back to something now that's more sustainable. So there are clearly a lot of businesses who think the banks are being too tough. But my overall assessment is that there is credit available there for both large and small businesses. You talk to the bankers and they want to lend.
Right.
It's the demand for credit's the issue, not the supply, I think.
Okay. Brian Singer spoke to us before lunch about consistency of policy, how important that is for businesses to be able to invest and for stock markets, in fact, to move ahead. You've had a change of government here in Australia recently. I know the RBA is not prone to political influence, but that must have some impact on your ability to be consistent in terms of your monetary policies. Can you just talk to us a little bit about that?
Well, I don't really think it has any impact. We, as I said before, we set monetary policy through the prism of our medium-term inflation target. Some of you may have noticed that this morning the governor and the new treasurer released a new statement on monetary policy understanding. Again, that reaffirmed the government's commitment to the inflation target. We've had that arrangement for 2 decades now. I think it's served us very well. That statement that was released this morning also reaffirms the independence of the Reserve Bank, the respect the government has for that independence, and it also reaffirmed the importance of transparency and accountability, because we feel this very strongly, that with the independence that the Parliament and the government has granted us, we need to be transparent and we need to be accountable. And all that, again, was reaffirmed by the current government. So I think in terms of the monetary policy framework, the change of government has very little, if no, effect.
Great. And the final question, and it's, we've worked you quite hard, so you'll be relieved, I'm sure, to hear this. But from your experience participating in global central bank meetings, do you have a view on the progress to improve the world's financial system and systemic risk in general? Do you think there's been enough policy coordination and enough progress towards resolving some of the issues that faced us during the crisis?
Yeah, well, very good questions. Australia's chairing the G20 next year, so we spent a lot of time in these international meetings and understanding what the priorities are. I think for us, the priority here is to actually implement what's been agreed, because there's been so much change. I can only imagine those in financial institutions, the difficulties they're having to kind of digesting all that. So our perspective here is we need to implement what's been agreed rather than starting off a whole new reform agenda. Has enough been done? I think only time will tell. The financial services sector got itself into tremendous trouble. It was not adequately capitalised. Parts of it didn't have enough liquidity. The credit assessment skills in some institutions were poor, and there were very serious ethical lapses in some financial institutions. And there's a reform agenda on each of those issues. It's being worked through. I hope and expect it will be enough, but time will tell. Fortunately, our banking system has been in good shape, so these issues have not been particularly relevant here, although obviously we feel the global effects of changes in regulation. And APRA is working through that with our financial institutions, and they're very well placed to deal with this. I think that the one extra observation I'd make is just how important the upcoming asset quality review in the euro area is. Because the one set of banks globally where people still have question marks, I think, are the euro area banks. And so this commitment by the ECB, which was announced yesterday, to do this asset quality review and stress testing, I think is incredibly important. It's important that it's seen as credible, thorough, and there are recapitalisation plans if they're necessary. So I see that as kind of the next key step in fixing the problems up. Thank you.